Good afternoon. My name is Steve, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Rate Announcement and Call Letter 2012 conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Sherry Rice, you may begin your conference.
Hello, welcome everybody. This is Sherry Rice. I am the Acting Director of the Medicare Plan Payment Group here at CMS. I am joined here today with several of my colleagues from the Center for Medicare, as well as several of my colleagues from the Office of the Actuary. The purpose of today's call is to discuss the key payment changes and updates that were announced in the 2012 Advance Notice and the Draft Call Letter that we released last Friday. For those of you who haven't seen it, the document is posted on the CMS website on the Medicare Advantage Rates and Statistics page under the Announcement and Documents link. We also sent the advance notice call letter individually to each plan through HPMS on Friday and throughout the weekend. We will be accepting comments on the notice and call letter until Friday, March 4th. Directions for submitting comments are included in the cover letter of the document. And once we review those comments, we will finalize the payment calculations and other policies and publish the final 2012 rate announcement and call letter on Monday, April 4th. So what we're going to do today is highlight some of the key items in the notice and the call letter, and then open it up for your questions. In terms of the items in the advance notice, they generally fall into two categories. You know, one category are the changes and updates that affect the county rates. The second category is changes that affect how we risk adjust payments. Now, for the county rates, as you've seen, if you've looked at the notice, we have a number of changes. First, 2012 is the first year that we begin to transition to a new capitation rate method as required by the ACA. So starting in 2012, each county rate will be a blend of two rates, one rate that is calculated under the old pre-ACA methodology, and two, the new rate that's based on a percentage of average fee-for-service costs in each county. So first, with respect to the pre-ACA portion of those blended benchmarks, they will be calculated as we always calculate those, which is calculated by trending the 2011 rates by the estimated growth percentage or annual growth in overall per capita spending in Medicare. Our preliminary estimate of that growth is 0.7%, and the details of that calculation are in Attachment 1. A couple things I want to note on the growth percentage. First is the statute requires that we incorporate adjustments for prior year over and under estimates into that calculation. Now, as you all know, there was a rate freeze in 2011. So in last year's rate announcement, we did not calculate an MA growth percentage for 2011. So that raised the question for us about how do we apply a prior year update for 2011, given that we didn't calculate a growth percentage. After consideration, we've decided to treat 2011 really no differently than we would any other year with respect to prior year updates. So we'll assume that there was an update in 2011 that update was zero, which is consistent with a rate freeze. Then following the typical process for calculating the growth percentage, then we go back and we apply a prior year update to reflect the actual growth in Medicare per capita spending for that year. And as you can see from Attachment 1, that prior year update is 2.75%. Second item to note on the growth percentage is that the preliminary estimate is based on current law. So that takes into account the scheduled 28% reduction in Medicare physician fees that is scheduled to take effect in January of 2012. Now, as we note in the cover letter, however, there is a temporary fix or permanent solution to the Medicare physician payment system that's enacted early in this year, it could be incorporated into the MA growth percentage for 2012. So in the final rate announcement in April, as we always do, we will issue a final estimate of the MA growth percentage. So we'll take the 2011 rates, trend them using to 12 using that final growth percentage. Now, the statute requires, however, that we take one additional step before setting the actual pre-ACA rates, and that's where we compare that trended rate to the fee-for-service rate for each county. And as you know, the statute requires that we rebase those fee-for-service rates once every 3 years. The last time we did it was in 2009. So we need to fee-for-service rebase those rates again for 2012. So we'll trend 2011 using the final MA growth percentage, compare that to the fee-for-service rebased rates for each county, take the higher of, and that will be the pre-ACA portion of the blended benchmark. So that's one part of the blended benchmark. The second piece is the new piece, the new fee-for-service-based rate. And we've laid out those statutory rules, reiterated those rules in the advance notice. So the fee-for-service-based rate, as you know, is set as a percentage of fee-for-service costs based on each county's quartile ranking. So counties with the highest fee-for-service costs get paid 95% of their costs, and counties with the lowest get paid 115%, and their gradations within that range. The transition period from the old to the new rate methodology is either 2, 4, or 6 years, and counties whose rates will decline the least have the shorter transition period, and counties whose rates change the most have the longer transition period. Now, to provide information for you about how different each county fares under these different rules, along with the advance notice, we posted a separate file on that same page. So you see when you hit the announcement and document link, you'll see the actual notice itself, and then a separate file which lists every county and what their quartile is and what their transition period is under our preliminary calculation. So you can view that file to get information that is specific to your plan and the service area that, you know, that your individual plans cover. Now, given that the ACA is transitioning the Medicare Advantage program to rates that are based on fee-for-service, the Office of the Actuary took this opportunity to review the process and the calculations that they undertake to calculate the fee-for-service rates. And in Attachment 1 of the notice, we describe several proposed improvements in that fee-for-service rate calculation methodology that has been recommended by our Office of the Actuary. Most of these changes are refinements to the average geographic adjustment, or AGA, methodology under which we calculate each county's fee-for-service rate relative to the national average. A couple that I do want to point out, for Puerto Rico, we are proposing to refine that AGA calculation to include only beneficiaries with both Part A and Part B, and we describe the reasoning for that change in the notice. Also, OACT has also considered how we might improve the AGA calculations to limit the effective sort of random year-to-year fluctuations in costs for small counties. And as a result of their study, we are proposing for counties with 1,000 beneficiaries or less to set a manual rate, which would be set at a weighted average of other county rates in the state. So I encourage you to read those sections, those descriptions, as well as the others around the refinements to the fee-for-service rate calculation. One thing to note, as with the other proposed changes to the AGA calculations, these would be phased in over a five-year period as years are added and dropped to that AGA calculation. So those are that sort of covers the fee-for-service rate component of the blended benchmark. Now, the other significant announcement that we included in the advance notice was the rules around the quality bonus payments. As you know, the ACA introduced quality bonus payments into the Medicare Advantage program for the first time starting in 2012. The bonus payments vary by contract based on each plan's star rating. Back in November, as you know, we announced a three-year demonstration that would test a method for setting those quality bonuses that would accelerate their implementation relative to the ACA structure and would scale them so that the higher a plan's star rating, the higher their bonus payment. In the notice, we have proposed a further refinement to the demonstration to further incent quality improvement. Under the original demonstration, the quality bonuses would be applied to the fee-for-service rate portion of the blended benchmark for all plans, with the exception of those with five-star. And for five-star plans, the bonus would be applied to the entire benchmark. So they would get, for example, they would get the full 5% bonus right away starting in 2012. Under the revised demonstration approach, we're proposing to apply that same methodology of applying that quality bonus percentage to the entire benchmark for all plans, not just the five-star plans. So that would significantly increase the amount of quality bonuses that are available to plans, in our hopes that that would further incent quality improvement over the period of the demonstration. And we are inviting comment not only on those, on that change, but also on the entire demonstration. All right, so that covers the quality bonus payments, and the changes to the benchmarks and so forth. Given the significant changes to the benchmarks that I just described through the demonstration, as well as the ACA rules, as well as the refinements to the fee-for-service calculation that OECD has recommended, we gave a lot of thought about whether to make any changes on that risk adjustment side, and decided that in the interest of some stability here, given all the other moving parts on the capitation rate side, that we would limit our changes to risk adjustment in Part C. So for 2011, as you know, we originally proposed to update and recalibrate the Part C risk adjustment model. We ultimately didn't go forward with that because of the rate freeze under the ACA for 2011. At that time, we indicated that we would go forward with that new model in 2012. And as I said, after considering all of the other payment changes that plans are going to need to adapt to in 2012, we decided to stay with the current Part C risk adjustment model for aged and disabled beneficiaries. And so that's what we put in the notice. In addition, in the interest of minimizing changes in Part C risk adjustment, we're also proposing to stay with the current 3.41 adjustment for coding pattern differences that we've used in 2010 and 2011. So for the main Part C model, the only change that you will see is an update to the normalization factor, and that normalization factor, as we note in the advance notice, is 1.079. When we did some rollout calls with the Hill and with the press on Friday, and you may have heard this number, we estimated the net payment impact of these changes to be 1.6%. And so I just want to walk through that with you a bit so you understand how we got to that number. The 1.6% is our estimate of the average update in the benchmarks. So that estimate takes into account the preliminary estimate of the MA growth percentage of 0.7, changes in the county rate calculation required by the ACA, that is the transitioning to the blend of the pre-ACA rates and the fee-for-service-based rates. It also takes into account the quality bonus adjustments to the county rates, and the 1.6 is based on the quality bonus payments, including the revisions to the demonstration that I just described, and is based on the plan's 2011 star ratings. The 1.6% does not include a couple of things. It does not include the positive effect on some county rates from fee-for-service rebasing. It does not include the negative effect on some county rates from the IME carve-out, or the relatively small effect of removing the budget neutrality adjustment of a tenth of a percent from the 2011 rates. And I think it's just important to emphasize that while we've estimated an overall average 1.6% benchmark update, that the payment change for any individual plan will really depend on the counties and their service area and their star rating. I think with the ACA changes now, with everything being driven on at a county level on these factors that vary by county, as well as the plan star rating, that there's just going to be a tremendous amount of variability across plans. So before handing over to my colleagues to discuss the call letter, I do want to quickly mention a couple of items on Part D. First, for 2012, we are making some adjustments to the RHCC model to ensure that it is in sync with the changes to the benefit mandated by the ACA. In addition to manufacturer discounts in the coverage gap, the ACA, as you know, reduces cost sharing in the gap under the defined standard benefit for non-low-income beneficiaries. So for 2012, we're proposing to update that Part D model to take into account this additional plan liability for generic drugs. In addition, the statute, as you know, requires that we increase the annual deductible, the initial coverage limit, and most of the other benefit parameters each year by the expected increase in Part D per capita costs, and we have included those updated parameters for 2012 in the notice, and they are typically about 3.3% higher than the 2011 parameters. So that concludes my overview of the advance notice items. At this point, I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Chris Bauer, to talk about some of the items in the call letter.
Thanks, Shari.
Hi, I'd like to go over a couple of the highlights on the Part D side of the call letter. The first thing that we'd like to point out to you is the 2012 calendar. You may notice that we have identified kind of activities that historically now are going to be a little earlier because of the annual enrollment period updating or being sooner than it's been in previous years. The thing that we'd like to note for that is that even though you may notice that there's not as many things checked as you would think moving up earlier, that you know, during the period where you're submitting formularies and bids and such, our ability to go back and, you know, re-review formularies if there's a mistake or give technical assistance this year is going to be more limited than it has been in previous years. So we really stress for you to review your materials and make sure that they are indeed what you want before you submit them. The next item I'd like to go over is the coordination of benefit user fee. This year we're proposing the COB fee to be $1.62, which is up from last year's level of $1.17. The next topic I'd like to highlight is quality reporting requirements for employer and union-only direct contracts. To better understand plan benefits beginning in 2012, all employer union-only direct contracts will be required to meet the same reporting requirements as MA or PDP contracts. Currently, Medicare Advantage contracts are required to collect and report to CMS quality measurement data from the Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Act, or HEDIS, and Medicare Health Outcome Survey, HAWS, and the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, or CAP. All standalone prescription drug plans are required to collect and report CAP data to CMS. The next highlight is the enhancement to future plan ratings. For 2012 plan ratings, we are proposing to add a number of new measures to the existing set used for the 2011 plan ratings. In particular, we're considering adding all-cause readmission rates, advising smoker and tobacco users to quit, body mass index, a number of special needs plan-specific measures, voluntary disenrollment rates, one or more measures from the hospital inpatient quality reporting program, appropriate implementation of Part D transition processes, by plans to ensure continuity of care for beneficiaries, and Part D medication adherence. For all measures, CMS will be examining the quality of data, variation among plans, and the measure's accuracy and validity. If measurements are not proven to be reliable and valid, CMS will determine whether such measures may be appropriate display measures, which would not be used in the plan star ratings. CMS is also considering using the same four-star thresholds that were set for the 2011 plan ratings. For 2012 and beyond, CMS will be setting four-star thresholds for measures with at least two-year data history. Additional enhancements under consideration for 2012 Part C and D plan ratings include weighting of the measures to provide greater weight to clinical outcomes and lesser weight to performance measures, controlling for concentration of providers in a geographic area, rewarding contracts for quality improvement, and reducing the overall and or summary plan ratings for contracts with serious compliance issues. The next highlight is contracting organizations with ratings of less than 3 stars in 3 consecutive years. We continue to have concerns about 3 or less star plans. contracting organizations should interpret a less than average or three-star summary rating on either their Part C or D performance to be a notice from CMS that they are to take corrective action and to come into compliance with program requirements. CMS considers organizations that fail for three straight years to achieve at least a three-star summary rating on Part C or Part D to have ignored over a significant period of time their obligation to meet program requirements and to be substantially out of compliance with their Medicare contract. The next topic is generic samples paid through Part D sponsors' administrative costs. Part D sponsors may contract with vendors to provide access to generic drug samples under the plan's administrative cost structure if doing so is consistent with the cost-effective drug utilization management program. The next topic is monitoring implementation of transition policy. As a result of audit findings, CMS remains concerned with whether Part D sponsors are appropriately implementing the transition policy. We are exploring several methods to determine if Part D sponsors are implementing their transition policy consistent with CMS's guidance and applicable regulation. To that end, sponsors would be required to provide documentation that their transition policy is correctly implemented in their claim system and beneficiaries are receiving their required transition supplies. The next highlight is loan enrollment plans for PDP. And here we're again be scrutinizing loan enrollment plans during the bid review process and we'll be expecting sponsors to have withdrawn or consolidated loan enrollment plans prior to submitting bids for CY 2012. We expect to particularly examine plans that constitute the lowest quintile per region of 2011 plans ranked by enrollment. While we are particularly concerned about the smallest plans, we urge sponsors to consider withdrawing or consolidating any standalone plan with less than 1,000 enrollees. And you know, this policy is consistent with our loan enrollment policy through the previous years. The final highlight is tier labeling and hierarchies. As a result of comments from beneficiary and advocacy stakeholders that a large number of drug tiers and non-standardized labeling of those tiers are confusing to beneficiaries, we revised the PVP and preliminary upload software in 2011 to accept a maximum of 6 tiers and establish a uniform set of tier label descriptions options based on the most common tier names used by Part D sponsors. CMS will allow a 6th tier if it is an excluded drug-only tier or a tier that provides a meaningful benefit offering such as a $0 vaccine-only tier, a low or $0 cost-sharing tier for special needs plans targeting specific conditions, or a injectable drug tier with cost-sharing that is at or below the cost-sharing for specialty drug tiers in the other 5 tiers. Plans offering supplemental benefits for excluded drug coverage that are not required to have this optional excluded drug-only tier may continue to offer excluded drugs on tiers that are shared by Part D covered drugs. CMS is also strongly encouraging sponsors to utilize certain tier labels and tiering hierarchy consistent with the industry standards established in the marketplace. And that's the highlights on the D side. I'll turn it over to Danielle Moon to go over the highlights on the C side. Danielle?
Okay, thanks, Chris. The main highlight on the C side in the call letter is the section we have on total beneficiary cost. And as you know, we exercised our authority under the ACA to deny bids that propose significant increases in cost sharing or decreases in benefits from one plan year to the next last year when we set up the total beneficiary cost metric as a means of evaluating those changes in plan benefits and whether or not such changes impose significant increases in cost sharing or decreases in benefits. TBC is the sum of plan-specific premium and estimated beneficiary out-of-pocket costs, and an indication in TBC is an indication, an increase in TBC is an indication that there's been a reduction in benefits. So this year, we are considering two approaches to the TBC analysis, and we're soliciting comments on both of those approaches. As you know, last year we established TBC requirements based on an outlier analysis that we did last year after bids were submitted, and then we negotiated with those plans that were identified as outliers. for 2012, one of our possible approaches is to follow that same approach, again, to apply that to all non-employer MA plans that existed in 2011 and will exist in 2012, and then do that same outlier analysis after bids are submitted. We would also note that in any approach, we would apply the TBC requirements to plan consolidations, where we have an existing plan consolidating into a new plan for 2012. That was something that we didn't consider or review in our analysis last year. The other approach that we're considering is instead establishing an adjusted TBC change amount based on historical data. And we would set this amount at a certain level, and then plans that have whose bids had a TBC at or below that specific threshold would not be subject to further scrutiny. Bids that have a TBC above the established threshold would be subject to further scrutiny by CMS and may be required to resubmit those bids within a very limited time period. I know Chris mentioned the earlier start date for the AEP, for the annual enrollment period. So there would be less time during that bid season to do the negotiations that we engaged in last year. Under this approach, we're proposing to set that TBC threshold at approximately $36 per member per month. We're, again, soliciting comments on this amount as well as the approach, again, whether to put a number, a threshold out there in advance or to do an outlier analysis after bids are submitted. We would also be looking at taking into account the different geographic and quality bonus payment related changes in each plan's payment rates, and we talk about that in the call letter as well. This is something as well that would be different this year because rates were frozen last year for 2011, so all of the plans were on a level playing field. So we would, and the final call letter, either we may choose the first approach or the second approach, using either that proposed change amount of $36 or a different amount, but we're soliciting comments on either of those approaches or the amount itself. And again, we're committed to providing whatever other information we can in advance of, well in advance of the bid due date in June, just as we did last year, and we realize the importance of getting information to organizations as early as possible. And so, as you can see in this call letter, we've included a lot of those thresholds and requirements already, and then we'll have further guidance with the final call letter as well as with our final rule that we expect to publish in April. Thank you.
So, Steve, that concludes our overview of the items, so I think we can move to the question period now.
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your telephone keypad. Please press pound if you'd like to withdraw your question. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A. And your first question comes from the line of Tom Ulinski from Tufts Health Plan. Your line is now open.
Hi. I just wanted to confirm something you said in the calculation of the 1.6% average increase. Did you say that you assume that the 3 to 4.5 star plans would get the full bonus payment and it would not be phased in that assumption?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so they would be applied to the full benchmark.
Okay. And then you mentioned it did not include the potential as high as 1.2% decrease for IME, and it didn't include a positive impact from revisions. Can you go in a little bit more detail about the positive impact for revisions? I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Yeah, the positive impact I was talking about is when we do that calculation on the pre-ACA portion of the blended benchmark, so the where we're taking the 2011 rate and trending it. The one thing we didn't take into account was the law requires that we compare that trended rate to the county fee-for-service rate, and if the fee-for-service rate is higher, that becomes the rate, the pre-ACA rate. So when you fee-for-service rebase, it always has the effect of increasing some rates. It never has a negative effect. But it will vary dramatically by county because in most counties it won't have an effect, but there are some where it will have an effect. So it really depends, and we just don't know at this point which counties will have a rebase fee-for-service rate that's higher than that trended rate that I mentioned. So it's hard to pinpoint with precision about the impact of that update, but it is positive.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Pierre Poisson from Health Policy Alternatives. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much. The advance notice is silent on the issue of the application of the new methodology for 2012 county rates and with respect to PACE programs. So I just wanted to be clear or understand what the policy is. Will PACE programs be exempt from this new methodology, from the blended benchmark methodology?
Yeah, PACE programs by statute are paid under the old rate.
Great. Thanks very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Marianne Granlich from Arcadian Health Plan. Your line is now open.
Yes, we just have a question on the timeline for getting bids back, where it's tighter now for getting the EOC ANOC out and having enough time, you know, for producing marketing materials and getting ANOC COCs printed. We're wondering on the expected date to get our bid back. Have you backed that date up in relation to the October 1st date?
Are you asking about the bid deadline, the initial bid deadline?
Well, not for us to get it in for CMS. Well, I suppose we thought that everything would be shifted back a month with the new change in open enrollment dates, the annual enrollment period dates.
Right. This is Danielle Moon. Right. We do expect that. We're condensing. We, when working with the Office of the Actuary, we are condensing our overall time frame for bid review and negotiations, as I briefly mentioned. I don't think we have a specific date that we've enumerated in the call letter, but we would be looking to really nail down, you know, those negotiations and finalize bids much sooner. I know sometimes our discussions went into August about last year, and we would be looking to close things out sooner, perhaps at the end of July, I think. I don't have the exact timeline in front of me, but it would be much on an accelerated time frame.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of David Perry from HealthSpring. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I noticed in the comment about the 1.6 that you mentioned, it did not include budget neutrality. I did not see anywhere in the release where it talked about it. But based on your comment, I'm assuming that 5% is still going to be implemented in 2012?
No, there's no budget neutrality. The law requires that we had phased that out over a multi-year period. And the last year that there was an add-on to the budget neutrality add-on was in 2010, and it was 0.1%. So what we do is when we calculate the rates going forward, we back out that budget neutrality amount from the prior year rate before we trend it. So the effect is really just taking out that 0.1% that was in that 2010 rate and effectively the 2011 rate before we grow it. So it's a relatively small percentage, and it's only that, you know, piece of the rate that's the pre-ACA rate. So I think, you know, the impact will be relatively small. But there, just to directly answer your question, there is no budget neutrality add-on going forward. It's just a matter of carving it out of that rate before we trend it.
Okay. And then the other question is, what in the 1.6 calculation, what was the average star rating that you assumed come up with the 1.6%?
We actually used we ran it at a planned level, at a detailed level, and built it up. So it's the actual 2011 star ratings for each of the plans that we used, that we posted in the fall.
What was the average weighted percentage?
I apologize. I don't have that number with me right now.
All right. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Bill Sarniak from Highmark. Your line is now open.
Yes, I just had a quick question to clarify the when you apply the quality bonus payments to the entire blended rate and to come up with the 1.6%, do you still apply the caps that the total rate can't be any higher than the pre-PPACA rate? Is that
no, the 1.6% assumes no cap.
And is that the way if it's implemented as in the original this advance notice that the cap will not apply?
The way we wrote it was that we're soliciting comment. We didn't say one way or the other about whether we would lift the cap or not, but that we are soliciting comment on whether we should or not, or to what degree we should. But for purposes of calculating the estimate, we assumed that it was not going to be applied.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Ruth Breedle from Gunderson Lutheran. Your line is now open.
Hi, I actually have two questions. The first one is, are you intending on moving back the date that marketing can start? It's October 1st, and that's actually taking 30 days of marketing prior to signing people up off the board, and we want to know if there's any possibility to put some of those days back.
This is Danielle Moon again. No, we've not contemplated, or we have contemplated, but we are not proposing to move the marketing date to any earlier than October 1st. We actually believe that having it at October 1st with the AEP starting on the 15th puts the program in a better position, puts things more in sync. When we had with the greater discrepancy between, say, October 1 and November 15th, we found that we had issues with organizations marketing and accepting marketing, which is fine, but accepting enrollment forms prior to that point. We had to have a whole policy around that, you know, around the acceptance of forms that maybe came in prior to that time. So we believe that having, you know, the marketing start on October 1 is in better sync with when we'll be putting out information on Medicare Options Compare and with the handbook.
The other question that I have is in regards to the special enrollment period for enrollment in a five-star MA plan. We are actually a coordinated care plan, and both of our applications are MAPDs, and we cannot have someone that can be on just an MA plan and then take a separate Part D plan, which is suggested in this document. Is there going to be any consideration for the coordinated care plans as far as enrollment if they obtain a five-star rating?
Sherry, do you want me to answer that? I don't know if you've got any folks from the enrollment group in the room.
I do not.
Okay. Just to maybe put a, this is Danielle Moon again. I guess, you know, I'm not sure that I understand your question. If you were to attain the five-star rating, then, you know, you would be able to enroll people continuously throughout the year. Now, if they had a standalone product, if they were in a standalone PDP, they would then need to drop that in order to pick up, you know, MAPD coverage.
The document only mentions that you can pick up MA-only plans. It doesn't say MAPD plans. It suggests that you can pick up an MA plan and you can continue to have your Part D plan separate. And that's not possible with coordinated care.
Right. Well, and that's true. It's generally not possible except in the case of privacy for service and in cost plans. We'll check back and look at that language and see if we need to issue a clarification.
Thank you.
Sure.
Your next question comes to the line of Linda Toros from Cigna. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question relates to the tier labeling and hierarchy that begins on page 116 through 118. The chart that's identified on page 118 for several of the options, it gives you the choice of a Tier 1 label of generic or preferred generic. But in some of the PBP communications that have been released earlier, it indicates that if you have a preferred generic label, you have to have a non-preferred generic label. And in some of the options within this table, it does not showcase a non-preferred generic label. So if somebody could look into that prior to the final issuance of this, that would be appreciated so that we can make sure that we're all in sync, we're all synchronized in terms of the formulary and the PBP tool submission.
Yeah, thank you for that. We've actually received a couple written comments on that already. And yeah, we're going to look into that issue in a little more depth.
Okay, and then my second question is, with respect to the comment in the call letter around trying to get more standardization and encouraging plans to stick to one of the options that are set forth here and separating generic and brand, tiers, in the PBP tool, will it be very clear in terms of the options that sort of you're encouraging plans to use?
I'd have to look at the PBP tool to see how clear it is.
Okay.
But we will, you know, kind of take that back and make sure that it's as clear as we can in the call letter.
Okay.
To have a better understanding of that.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Kristen Greeley from First Medical Health. Your line is open.
Hi there. I'm hoping you can clarify regarding the Part B premium buy-down for 2012. Are we allowed to do that? And if we are not allowed to do it, does that include that prohibition include employer group or not?
This is Danielle Moon, and I'll defer to others if they have more knowledge of this on the phone. But we, you know, from our bid staff, but as far as I know, we're not prohibiting organizations from buying down the Part B premium. Is there something in particular that led you to think that that was the case?
Yes, information from an actuary. So
okay.
I wanted to confirm
Okay, but there wasn't anything you saw in the call letter. I know we actually talked about...
No, the call letter references premium buy-down, so that was where my...
Right, actually what we are doing in the section on CBC that I know we mentioned it,
right,
is that we are taking that into account as part of the benefit package. So maybe that's what the person saw and thought that there was a problem there, but we are certainly contemplating that organizations would be offering that as a benefit.
Okay, so for Part B, we can continue to offer a premium buy-down.
Right.
2012.
Yes, and this is Rich Coyle from the Office of the Actuary. And, yes, we acknowledge that there was some confusion with regarding different versions of the bill that was ultimately passed. And it's my understanding personally that Part B buy-downs will be permitted for 2012, but we will be sure to clarify that in both the bid instructions and in the final notice as well.
Very good. Thank you. That answers my question.
Yeah, we do have a section in the notice. I'm just trying to find the page number here that does provide some background on that issue. So,
yeah, it specifically says that the policy that we're proposing to adopt is that the same categories for rebate allocation that have been used previously will continue to be used, and that includes Part B premium buy-down.
Yeah, and that's on page 13 of the notice.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa Lashbrook from Fallon Community Health. Your line is now open.
Yes, actually, we just have a question of clarification around the combined Part C and D oopsie. On page 95, it mentions that it needs to be at least $22. And then later on in the call letter on page 113, under the heading of cost sharing out-of-pocket cost differential analysis, it says that for the cost sharing difference of $16 between two enhanced plans in the same service area, We're just looking for confirmation if an MAPD is $22 if you have two enhanced plans in the same service area, or is it $16?
On the Part D side, the value between the two enhanced plans needs to be $22.
So for on page 95 where it says a combined Part C and D, oopsie, of $22 is not actually what it should be. Should it be the Part C is $22 and the Part D is $16? Do you understand where I'm getting confused on this?
Danielle, and I'm looking at that language as well, but I don't understand your question. I mean, we're saying that the difference when combining the two must be at least 22. Last year it's 20. This year it's 22 to be the same as the difference between, I think, on the D side. So.
So I guess the question is on page 113, are you only talking to PDPs? Which is talking about the $16 between?
The $16 is between two enhanced alternative plans within a standalone PDP.
It is standalone PDP.
Your next question comes from the line of Jill Brostowitz from Security Health Plan. Your line is now open.
Hi, could you give the impact of the negative 28% fee schedule to the total MA growth percentage?
It's roughly 6%.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa Williams with Coventry Healthcare. Your line is open.
I have a couple of questions. On the RxHCC model recalibration, will CMS send a beneficiary file this year to assist plans with valuing the impact of the change consistent with last year?
That's under consideration at the moment. Last year was a different situation in that plans did not have necessarily all the RxHCCs that could feed a re-tabulation of the factors because the model was new, but because the model has been implemented in 2011, in effect now on a file which is called the model output file, plans have access to all the parameters that go into the new model, and what has changed here merely are the coefficients. So we may do that yet, Lisa. It hasn't quite been decided whether to go at the beneficiary level or to give aggregate plan scores as we've done in the past and let the plans assign the new coefficients to the model output file information they have when they could recalculate a beneficiary score. So we're not quite there yet on that decision.
Okay. And also on the RxHCC file, is the expected impact of all the changes that the risk score aggregates back to 1, or do you expect a global decrease in the risk score since you've taken into account the change in the plan?
It'll go back to 1. We recalculated the denominator as well, so the aggregate impact will be neutral.
Yes. And then one final question on the out-of-pocket cost calculator that's going to be published in April, the SAS code. My question is, can CMS provide any advanced guidance on the required model inputs to get a calculated value? For example, if I think about Part D, one of the impacts to the OOPSI is formulary. So if we could get some kind of advance notice of the level of detail required to input a formulary, it would allow us to hit the ground running when the calculator is published in April.
This is Cynthia. It's not clear we're going to release anything else, but you have all the technical specs that were released a year ago, and that ought to help you figure out what the inputs required are.
Your next question comes from the line of Robert Garbus from Cigna. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. This is actually just a follow-up to Sean's response, mentioning that the last year we didn't have access to all the HCCs that we would need to recalculate the risk adjusters. Actually, since the base period would be 2010 for the 2012 bids, I don't believe we'll have the HCCs to recalculate it for this year's bid either.
Just give us a second here. Thank you for the question. I understand where you're coming from, and if it turns out that, and as you suggest, that you don't have the model inputs to calculate the scores, we will, of course, provide beneficiary level file.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa Dan with Aetna. Your line is open. It appears she has withdrawn her question, and there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you again, all of you, for joining us today. We hope this call was helpful, and again, the comments are due on March 4th. We'll be reviewing those comments and then issuing the final rate announcement on April 4th. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.